LID Radio is proud to announce its partnership with the Institute of Leadership and Management and their weekly recap hosted by Matt Packer.
Welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly podcast, where we critically examine some topical developments with a leadership and management theme. I'm business and finance journalist Matt Packer, and in this episode I'll be exploring stories up to Friday the 27th of July. Joining me in this analysis, as ever, is the Institute's Head of Research, Policy and Standards, Kate Cooper. Hello there, Kate.
Hello, Matt.
Okay, well, we're opening this podcast with a story that's by turns sad and cautionary. On the 22nd of July, it emerged that Welsh building contractor Cuddy Group had been forced to go into administration following a difficult past 2 years in which MD Mike Cuddy was hospitalised for 6 months with a serious illness, then spent a further 18 months recuperating at home. In a statement, the firm explained that Mr. Cuddy's absence had led to a challenging period of business and that, quote, he had hoped that others would have stepped up to fill the gap he had left. Unfortunately, this did not happen, and the challenges facing the company increased month on month throughout 2017 and into 2018, close quote. Cuddy, who poured 30 years of his life into the firm, is reportedly devastated. What would you say are the lessons from this company's failure?
Well, we speak quite a lot about over-reliance on founders who cannot hope to be responsible for everything as the business grows. And it's really beholden upon him in this instance to have actually had some sort of succession plan behind him,
yeah,
or at least cover when he isn't well. 2 years is a long time out of your business, but it'd be interesting to see how it was performing before he went and whether there were actual problems with the business anyway that maybe he could have solved or turned around had he been there. But certainly the responsibility for not having a plan in place for
this kind of eventuality
is definitely a cautionary note, I think, to anybody who over-relies on their physical presence in a business.
It says an awful lot, I think, about the need to develop people. Because if his concern is that people just weren't able to step up, then clearly key staff should have been identified and groomed for that possibility.
Well, the responsibility is absolutely his. If he had been doing a good job, his company would have been able to run without him being there. So it was a real lack on his part to not have given people the autonomy, the freedom, the encouragement, whatever it took for them to be able to manage without him.
Yes, absolutely. All right, well, for our second story, we're turning to a firm that's seen a marked improvement in its fortunes. The company in question is New Zealand-based estate planning firm Permanent Guardian, which recently conducted an 8-week trial where it slashed the working week from 5 days to 4. Now, what really makes this experiment compelling is that the company appointed 2 HR academics to measure the initiative's effects. They detected significant rises in staff satisfaction levels across areas such as work-life balance, commitment, empowerment, and the firm's overall leadership. But most importantly, there was no drop in the firm's productivity. Does this prove that most organisations are approaching the productivity riddle in the wrong way?
I think what this tells you is that once you give something attention and once you focus on it, great things can happen. And I think the idea of going to a 4-day week, well, how exciting is that? And I think you come into work with an extra spring in your step, thinking, this is marvellous. I can get everything done in 4 days and I can have the 5th day off. The real challenge for this organisation is to make it sustainable. Because when somebody joins an organisation and it's a 4-day-a-week contract, they won't remember when we used to have to work 5. They have bought into something. And then I imagine you get all that creep that you get in any organisation, which is really an important part of the glue that keeps it going, which is the working on the relationships. It's having the meetings that go on a bit longer than perhaps you'd like, but other things are happening at the same time.
Yeah.
And this focus on results and focus on outcomes. But is it sustainable if you're stripping out everything else?
Yeah. Something that I find quite fascinating about this is people may well be compelled to put in more effort into those 4 days than they were in the 5. So over a long time span, I wonder whether employees would end up becoming more exhausted by having to put in so much effort into 4 days, having to pack all of that adrenaline and that motivation in.
Well, that's the sustainability argument, isn't it? I mean, can you be in a results delivery mind frame all day? I'd suggest probably not, but it's still really interesting as an exercise in what are we wasting time on that we could well use more productively.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well, next up, we're casting our eyes over an area of workplace politics that workers find notoriously tricky, namely managing upwards. In a recent interview, Cardiff City coach Neil Warnock discussed the club's prospects in the Premier League following its promotion from the Championship at the end of last season. While Warnock said that broadly he has a good relationship with the club's owner Vincent Tan, he added, quote, "I've had a struggle at times. I think managing upwards is more difficult at times than managing the team," close quote. Why does managing upwards present such a challenge, and what's the most effective way to go about it?
Managing upwards is such an important part of everybody's job, but so much energy and indeed HR systems are all focused on managing downwards. But it's never really mapped out for you how you should manage your boss. And as a young graduate once said to me, well, you know, I thought work was about making your boss look good. I think if more of us had that sort of mentality and we had bosses that really appreciated what we do and help us to make them look good, I think we're a very different dynamic. So rather than telling people what to do, it's much more of a servant approach. How can I help you make me look good? Investing in making that relationship with your boss work is something perhaps you should do before you do anything else.
Yes, something that's quite interesting about this debate is, if you seem to be overtly questioning a particular strategic decision, is that an unhelpful expression of managing upwards?
I think the manager has to have a confidence in their own worth, in the value that they add to the organisation, and to appreciate that challenge, as long as it's constructive, is really, really useful. You just don't want a lot of people agreeing with you, and you don't want a lot of people hiding things from you, I think, more importantly. And two heads are better than one. So if you have an idea and you have a trusting relationship with your team and you can say, what do you think about that? And they know that you are receptive to honest feedback. How much better is that for everybody? And so in that situation, I'd say to the manager, if you're feeling threatened by the people who work for you, spend some time thinking, what's that really telling you? And it's telling you far more about yourself than it is about them.
Yes. All right, and finally, scientific research has uncovered a gender gap in what people consider to be a rude interruption. As explained in an article over at Inc.com, Stanford linguist Catherine Hilton carried out an experiment where she played a set of carefully scripted conversations to 5,000 Americans. According to Stanford's in-house journal, quote, male listeners were more likely to view women who interrupted another speaker in the audio clips as ruder, less friendly, and less intelligent than the men who interrupted, close quote. Hilton herself said, quote, finding this gender bias wasn't as surprising as the extent of it, close quote. Now, this has pretty clear implications for areas such as managing upwards, as well as meetings culture in general, doesn't it?
What's always interesting about these so-called new findings is that they've been known for decades. Dale Spender did some terrific work in the 70s and 80s looking at how men and women use language. And if seemingly a disproportionate number of female contributions are made, when they're actually analysed, they're not even half. Mm-hmm. And you hear it so often from women that they'll make a suggestion and then a few minutes later, the same suggestion's made by a male colleague and it gets more respect and more credibility. And that is the daily experience of so many women in organisations. And of course, they can't change that. The attitudes have to change from the men who are controlling many of the conversations.
And taking credit for a lot of the ideas.
But I don't believe that they're doing this consciously. Mm. If you think about how power flows, especially in a meeting, if somebody says something quite low down the power hierarchy, it doesn't get the interest and support of people there. Somebody else says it, and all of a sudden it has the interest and it has the support. And I don't think men are consciously saying, I'll take this idea and I'll make it my own. I think it's just the ebb and flow of conversation and the way ideas grow. Mm. But this idea that women, when they interrupt, are somehow behaving differently to men who interrupt is something that needs to be taken seriously.
Yeah. Okay, well, that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section of the Institute's website, which can be found at www.institutelm.com. That's www.institutelm.com. Thank you very much indeed for your insights, Kate. I look forward to exploring a new set of stories with you next week.
Thanks, Matt.